Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars, artists, and librarians about research and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. I'm delighted to have as my guest on the program today Holly Pepe. Holly is a scholar, editor, global public relations strategist, and an authority on the poetry of Edna St. Vincent Millay, as well as Millay's literary executor, who's been on the board of the Millay Society for many years. Holly's also a poet herself, as well as an essayist and translator. She's here to talk with us about Edna St. Vincent Millay and the exhibition Treasures from Steepletop, on view in the main library, the Art Library, and the Francis Lehman Loeb Art Center here at Vassar College through June 11th. And then there's a follow-up exhibition at Steepletop itself of material from the Vassar Collection about Millay.
Yes, that's correct. That will open in May.
So welcome, Holly.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's wonderful that you could do this. So can you give us some background about Millay and Steepletop, and also perhaps about her life there?
Sure. Well, first, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be working with Vassar on the exhibition and also on an event that will take place there on February 18th that we can talk about. Millay's dates are 1892 to 1950. She was the eldest of three daughters. She was raised in Maine by a single mother, Cora Millay, who actually supported the family as a private duty nurse. So she was away from home much of the time. And Cora herself was a rather liberated woman in her day. She divorced her husband in 1900 when Millay was 8 and her two sisters, Norma and Kathleen, were 6 and 3 years old. And Cora did struggle to make ends meet, but she provided her daughters, all three daughters, with a steady diet of poetry, literature, music, and she encouraged them, really by example, to write poems and songs and stories. So even though they lived very modestly in rented spaces.
It was a hard life, by all accounts.
In Camden, Millay was brought up with this wonderful cultural background. And we must credit her mother, and I'll talk more about her mother because she was very close with her mother.
Cora.
Adored her, Cora. So Millay, now, interesting to note, she was called Vincent by family and friends all her life. Now, she wrote poetry all her life, and her range of subjects is extraordinary, from nature, love, loss, death, the resurrection of the human soul, those sort of universal subjects, to commentaries on politics, on women's rights, on personal freedom. And starting in grammar school, she published her poetry in a magazine called St. Nicholas Magazine for young readers, and she won the top prize.
So there used to be literary magazines for children, which is interesting, that children could actually publish in.
That's right, and they had prizes, and Millay published, and she always won the prizes. And interesting that she published under the name E. Vincent Millay, or E. St. Vincent Millay, because she was hiding her gender even then.
Even as a child.
Now, in 1912, her life changed, because at her mother's suggestion, she had written a poem called Renaissance, which was actually originally called Renaissance. And it was a long poem, 107 rhyming couplets, describing a life-altering spiritual awakening, which she herself claimed that she had. And she entered it in a poetry contest, and the winners would receive cast prizes. But all of the entrants would be included in a book called The Lyric Year, 1912, which was an anthology. Now, her poem didn't win. She did enter it under E. Vincent Millay. But when it appeared in the anthology in 1912, everyone considered it the best poem in the book, even the winners. And they all assumed that the poet was male and much older than 20 years old, which was Millay's age at the time. And in fact, some of the poets who'd entered, namely Arthur Fickey, who later became a close friend and lover of Millay, actually, wrote to the editor, and he said, "No sweet young thing of 20 ever ended a poem where this one ends. It takes a brawny male of 45 to do that, if they'd only known." And, of course, they did find out pretty quickly. So after graduating high school, there was no money. Again, they were still living in Maine. And
she thought she was probably going to end up marrying a farmer, as most girls would have done in that community.
Perhaps, but in this family, that probably would not have been the case.
Maybe not.
So she did have to stay home, though, and take care of her sisters while her mother continued to work outside the home most of the time. And at one point, and this is quite a wonderful story, it's the beauty of coincidence, Norma was working at an inn called the Whitehall Inn in Camden one summer, and there was a party, masquerade party and a rather a bit of a talent show.
Mm-hmm. And Norma's her sister.
Norma is her second sister. Norma and Kathleen. Norma was second, and Kathleen was the youngest. Mm-hmm. And she asked Millay if she would take part, and Millay didn't really want to go, but she did. She played some of her songs at the piano. Mm-hmm. And then she recited Renaissance. And a woman in the audience who was very interested in the beauty of that poem and the sophistication of it, especially for a girl that age, mm-hmm. a young woman that age, suggested that she could help her go to college. And she was actually a representative from Barnard in Manhattan at the YWCA. Caroline Dow was her name. Mm-hmm. She helped Millay choose a college, and mm-hmm. Millay decided on Vassar.
And was Dow a graduate of Vassar herself? No, she wasn't.
Oh, she wasn't. She wasn't. Yeah. But she was very interested in having Millay go. There's some marvelous letter excerpts in which Millay talks about Smith versus Vassar mm-hmm, uh-huh. and decide because there are foreigners, huh? as in foreigners yeah. at Vassar, that she'd be much more interested in going to this.
International students, that's interesting, way back then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so.
Yes, she names a girl from Japan, uh-huh. a woman from Japan. Mm-hmm. So she did attend Vassar from 1913 to 1917, and following those years she moved to Greenwich Village, mm-hmm. which is the time in her life most people know about.
Yeah.
She was always a free spirit, as you could hear from her childhood. Mm-hmm. She enjoyed this bohemian lifestyle happening in the village in the day. And she started publishing poems right away in popular magazines like Vanity Fair, mm-hmm. Ainsley's, The Forum. She was also publishing in slim volumes mm-hmm. that were being passed around hand to hand. And she was attracting wide readership.
Yeah, she became famous really quite early,
yes, well, she started at Renaissance. If you remember that mm-hmm. when Renaissance, she was only 20, and then she went to college after that. Mm-hmm. So she was 21 when she entered Vassar. Mm-hmm. And by the time she came out, she was continuing to write while she was at school. Mm-hmm. So this readership really, it started out as a young readership. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was the sort of disillusioned post-war generation.
Yeah.
They were rejecting the status quo. Yeah. They wanted to break free from the social confines of their parents' generation, express themselves openly. I mean, it was just like any other youth movement.
Yeah.
They longed to be independent, and it was Millay's voice mm-hmm. that really assured them yeah. this was possible.
Especially women.
And especially yeah. women, yeah. But I will say that she spoke for the generation.
Yeah.
Probably the most quoted four lines by Millay are, "My candle burns at both ends, it will not last the night. But on my foes and oh my friends, it gives a lovely light." And that became the mantra, really, for her readership and for her generation. Now, while she was in New York, and, you know, you could do a whole interview on just her time in the village, which is so rich and exciting.
People that she attracted and
And her coterie of lovers also, you know, she her lovers included Floyd Dell, John Peel Bishop, Edmund Wilson, really the literati of the day, and others, Widder Binner. But Millay also acted with the Provincetown Players. Mm-hmm. And she, of course, you knew Eugene O'Neill there. Uh-huh. And she wrote her own play, Aria da Capo, mm-hmm. which is an anti-war play still being performed.
Interesting.
And she directed that play. And that play won really marvelous reviews mm-hmm. from the New York Times mm-hmm. and others. So this was her time in the village. She was, once again, very independent. She chose her work over marriage. She ended up going to Europe, to mm-hmm. Paris, and traveled for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. But by 1923, we're sort of moving towards Steepletop. But in 1923, she returned from Europe and won the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry, which was a new prize, by the way. It's only the second year it was awarded.
Yeah, so she was the first woman to win it, but it was an early prize.
It was an early prize.
She was one of the first ones they gave out. Yes.
That same year, 1923, she won the prize, and she won the prize not for Renaissance, which mm-hmm. people often assume, but instead for one poem called Ballad of the Harp Weaver, which she wrote for her mother, 8 sonnets, which had been published in an American Miscellany, an anthology. Mm-hmm. These are all love sonnets, and a few figs from thistles, which mm-hmm. was her second collection.
Yeah.
So those three together were really the source of that Pulitzer Prize for $1,000. And she was thrilled about the $1,000, of course. Now that same year, 1923, she was at a house party, Croton-on-Hudson, mm-hmm. with Arthur Fickey, I mentioned earlier, whom she had had an affair with but now was marrying someone else.
Yeah.
And she met a man named Eugen Boissevain, who was a Dutch coffee merchant. And they met, and very quickly they united. They decided they would marry.
Uh-huh.
She wasn't well at the time. They married, and then he drove her immediately down to New York for surgery, for intestinal surgery.
Oh.
or appendix surgery. Uh-huh. We're really not quite sure, yeah. But in any case, she did, just before going under the knife, she said, if I die now, at least I'll be immortal.
So was that a chance meeting? Because I know Eugen's first wife was a Vassar graduate, yes.
Yes, yeah, but, his first wife was Inez Mulholland,
uh-huh,
and
yeah.
She was a famous suffragette.
Uh-huh, yes.
And she died, unfortunately, very young.
Yeah.
Just a quick aside is that Inez was a Vassar graduate and actually went to Vassar to watch a pageant mm-hmm. when Millay was at Vassar. And so they met.
Oh, interesting.
And then about 10 years later, after Inez had died, in this sort of incredible 5 degrees of separation,
mm-hmm.
Eugen met Millay.
Uh-huh.
And as you can hear, I mean, you might imagine, he loved very strong women.
Yes, uh-huh.
And
yes, yeah.
In the case of Millay, certainly their build was not the same.
And,
but they
and he seems a very strong character himself, and that he allowed her complete freedom, a very gallant individual.
Yes, he was devoted to Millay.
Yes.
And he felt it was most important that his role be a support role.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And he'd also, interestingly, been psychoanalyzed by Jung. And
interesting.
And so he believed in free marriage, mm-hmm. he believed in free relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is not to say that when that was actually in progress, that he was 100% on board.
Yes.
But he did indeed
adjust.
Philosophically. Philosophically,
yes, okay,
at least,
yeah.
He was very supportive.
Yeah.
So it was, now we're back in 1923, back to 1923. They met, they married, and they went on a honeymoon trip around the world, an 8-month honeymoon trip, several months later. And when they returned, Millay decided that she couldn't really work in the city. She couldn't write in the city. And she wanted to move, maybe to the country. Looked in the New York Times, found an ad for $9,000, 435 acres,
mm-hmm.
and a berry farm, an abandoned berry farm up in Austerlitz, New York.
Mm-hmm. It's probably a lot of money back then, I'm sure.
Yes.
Maybe not for what she was getting, but...
But I think she was getting a lot of acreage with nothing on it.
Yes,
it was a farmhouse and a few outbuildings, a few barns.
Yeah. It's rough country a bit. It's up in the mountains. So,
right. And it's a few hours north of New York.
Mm-hmm.
So they purchased it, and very soon after, they added another 300 acres. So they really had land as far as they could see. So it was tremendous privacy.
Yeah.
Now, they needed to do a huge amount of work, as one does often with an old country house, and they transformed the property into this really rather elegant country estate with guest houses, tennis court, an outside bar with benches and a fountain.
Mm-hmm.
They had
a spring-fed pool
where they and the guests would swim en natural.
Mm-hmm.
Outdoor dressing rooms with cast iron dressing tables and a badminton court. All these outdoor rooms were accessible through wooden doors that were hanging between trees.
Oh.
And I'll talk a little more about Steepletop in a little bit, but we are now reconstructing those doors outside. So Eugen really fancied himself a gentleman farmer. He purchased a Sears and Roebuck barn, which is still on the hill, and he bought livestock, he bought horses, and Millay loved riding. Mm-hmm. There are really two sides to Millay that we'll hear more about as we go along, and we'll see in the exhibition as well. But there really was this public and private Millay, and she hunted, she had her own .22 hunting rifle, and she loved to ride horses.
So she took to the country.
She took to the country, and remember, she'd been brought up in Maine.
Yes, yeah.
So there was this part of her that really, nature was, not only was it her first love, she'd been brought up, of course, by the sea, but it was also a great inspiration for her poetry.
Yeah.
That's probably her main theme throughout, and the use of symbolism in nature really permeates her work. So she did love riding. She had her own horse and saddle.
We have in my library in the exhibit
just the saddle, not the horse.
Not the horse, no.
So on display.
No, but a riding crop and a rifle.
And a rifle. Mm-hmm. And while she wrote poetry, now at Steepletop, she wrote in a cabin, which a lovely wooden outdoor cabin on the hill, and she had a full research library upstairs in the house. And there at Steepletop, really, she did some of her finest work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she composed an opera libretto, The King's Henchman, which opened at the Met in 1927, several poetry collections, book of translations from Baudelaire, Fleur de Mal, and several long poems commissioned by the Writers' War Board.
Yeah. The library is expressive, for me, to some extent, of who she is, and also her poetry, in that, A, she obviously did get a literary education, Vassar, English literature, French literature, European literature generally. And also, if you read her poetry closely, it's very elusive. I mean, she sometimes critiqued, you know, from a modern perspective, she's not like T.S. Eliot, where she doesn't have these sort of obvious allusions to, you know, world literature, but really it's so integrated into her work. She's very, very familiar with the 17th century English tradition of Dunn and Company. Just a little observation
yes,
there in passing,
yes,
just mentioning her library, because the library is an important part of what she was doing.
Exactly. And being
a librarian.
And the classics. She really based much of her work on the classics, and there are classical references throughout her work, and that really did come from Vassar, because her favorite subject there was Latin.
Oh, was it? That's
yes,
so
it
interesting.
Was.
Yeah.
And Latin prose composition, and she was really, in many ways, a classical scholar.
So as much as she's often contrasted, say, with H.D., you know, sort of symbolists who use that material in a symbolic way, she uses it also very much, doesn't she?
Yes, but so, I would say that H.D. is slightly more obscure in her use of imagery, and Millay is not.
Yeah.
And one of the challenges we've had with Millay, really all along, is her use of archaic language and that classical symbolism that sometimes escapes the modern reader. And not to say the modern reader is not sophisticated, but sometimes the language will put people off, and even though there are very modern sentiments expressed.
Yes.
Sometimes she alludes to classical imagery, but then sometimes she'll use that language to bring it right up to date and talk about riding in the subway.
Yeah.
So it's true. And it was her reliance on traditional form that really separated her from the modernists.
Sonnets and
right, the sonnet, the song, the
new
elegy.
New wine in old bottles in a way. Yes.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. She really loved traditional form, and she stayed with traditional form all the way through.
Yeah.
I think her sonnets, which have been called some of the finest in the language, and I think that's probably true. Her sonnets, if you look at her with a biographical critical eye, you could say that her sonnets reflected her life. But in fact, she loved to pose in her poems. And so you're never really quite sure
who
the woman speaker, the female speaker is sometimes Millay, perhaps, and sometimes not. And
Well, she thought of herself as an actress to some extent also, didn't she?
Yes, she did. Probably not later in her life, but certainly early on.
Yes,
but that posing, I think you see mostly in Fatal Interview.
Yeah.
That's a sequence of 52 sonnets published in 1931. And it traces the course of a failed love affair. I would say rather generally. It's not poem for poem and sonnet for sonnet. But you do see at the beginning, she sets the stage for it. And she says, "The scar of this encounter, like a sword, will lie between me and my troubled lord." And she was referring to meeting a young poet, George Dylan, in 1928, when she was on a reading tour, and having an affair with him while she was, of course, married to Eugene. And having that conflict really drive her and inspire her to write, which was in many cases Millay, and she certainly admitted that love, romantic love, fueled her poetry. And that was one of the reasons she didn't really want to commit. She never wanted to be pinned down in a way. Although she was true to Eugene in every other way, and he was, as I said, a great support to her, he understood the need for that passionate flare-up that was needed for her to produce more poetry.
And those are astonishingly beautiful poems, I mean, among her work.
And I think the poem that is probably one of the best known, Love Is Not All, was probably written about George Dylan, but many of the others were not necessarily. So I think today when you enter the house at Steepletop, when you actually visit, after what we've just said about Millay, when you get to know her a little bit and you realize these both two, you know, this two parts of this world are happening, you realize that even what went on there, you know, they had these wonderful parties at the outdoor bar where she said the flowers are watered with gin. And Eugene and Millay actually invited George Dylan, her lover, to come to Steepletop.
That's
which
what I mean,
he did.
Yeah, gracious and gallant fellow.
And he was accepted by Eugene there because, once again, Eugene wanted to be open-minded. And you can sort of imagine them all sitting on the couch in the living room by the stone fireplace, the living room they call the withdrawing room, or playing the two pianos, or two pianos in that room as well. There's a bust of Sappho in the corner. All of that is exactly as it was.
And a little ordinary farmhouse.
Yes, a little farmhouse. And I think one of the sort of fun fact about their life at Steepletop is that every night they dress for dinner. And they had formal china, and you can walk in today and see the dining room is set with the silver and formal china.
So it's an interesting juxtaposition of the very ordinary and the very extraordinary, you know, and that she manages to bring her taste into, they both do, obviously. But
and the European tradition.
And
they had, they called them servants, but they were actually, usually they have a couple there, sometimes from abroad and sometimes American, who would act as the butler and the mm-hmm. and the she had chef.
A little butler under the table to call for service.
Yes, a foot press where so they could call the butler.
Interesting mix of formality and informality.
So, yes, and I think that part of it was the imagination, and I think part of it is that Malaya, even though she's come from humble beginnings, there was a piece of Malaya, part of Malaya, that felt that she was slightly removed from it all as a poet.
Yeah.
She did see herself. There's a bit of the ivory tower there. We see it in some of her letters, for example. And she was fanatical about the exact way that her poems should be presented with the punctuation. Everything about the poem had to be exactly as she wished.
Yeah. Did she revise a lot as she wrote? Like Sylvia Plath over and over, you know, redoing the same poem?
She did. Yeah. And you'll see that there are differences between the books, between the different volumes. The edition.
So there's an end of St. Vincent Millay Society that you're a longtime member of, yes?
Yes.
So is that a society anyone can join? Is it, could it be like a fan club possibly? Or, you know,
not a fan
like
a, club at all, but definitely anyone can join the society. Yeah. It is a membership group. We're based on education, of course, because what has happened with the house, when Millay died in 1950, Norma, that's her younger sister, moved into the property, the Steepletop House, with her husband, who was a painter named Charlie Ellis, who had also acted in the Provincetown Players.
And some of his painted medallions are on display in the main library now,
That's right. And his medallions were actually in the entranceway to the various outdoor rooms Rondels.
Okay.
But his paintings are also at Steepletop. And he was one of Mrs. Whitney's fair-haired boys in the Art Students League in New York. So he has his own history.
Yeah.
But Norma and Charlie moved into Steepletop in 1951, the year after Millay's death. And in 1964, she founded the Millay Society. Now, that was originally, the idea was a non-profit organization to promote Millay's poetry. But after Norma died in 1986, when she was 92, we broadened the society's goal to include preserving the home, Millay's home, gardens, as well as sharing all of her work, which includes not just poetry, but songs, poems, essays, etc. So today we are really the keepers of the flame. And the Millay Society maintains the property. We're restoring the property, restoring the house and the gardens. It's a national public landmark. In 2010, with the help of a really wonderful team of volunteers, and volunteer docents who are still with us, and we have many new additions as well, and we started offering house and garden tours and other events also in the spring and the fall. And when you visit Steepletop, we also have a poetry trail lined with poems. You can walk up a wood road, and it ends at the Millay family gravesite, which is really a wonderful pilgrimage. And we have people who come from all over the world.
Is she buried there?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't realize.
There, yes. As well as Eugen and her mother, Cora, Norma, and Charlie as well. You know, if you want to revisit the 1920s and 30s and see how this sort of bohemian jazz age poet lived in the country, it's just well worth the trip. So I would say Malay.org, I'll put a little plug in.
If we get Malay. I'll link it to the Library Cafe website.
Wonderful. You know, with and you can visit for tours May 1st through November 1st.
And I have to say, I was there in the autumn. It's just spectacular scenery all around.
Yes.
I mean, it's nestled into the Berkshires there.
Right.
Yes.
And, very beautiful.
Views everywhere, and the farm is really lovely. It's a blueberry farm, yes.
Yes, it was a blueberry farm originally.
You still grow blueberries there, you seem to. I mean, they're still there growing anyway.
And
so
we have had a wonderful gardener, Michael Minchak, who really has restored many of the gardens and got started on the rose garden.
Yeah.
They're rebuilding the bar. So more and more, obviously, we're looking for support all the time to help us do that, but we're restoring that property. We really want to restore it to the way it was when Millay lived
there. So is there a perennial garden? One of my favorite poems of hers is The Hardy Garden, and I wonder if it had to do with her own little garden there. So can you tell us about the materials selected for the exhibition at Vassar? The four seasons seem to be an organizing principle, don't they? And also, of course, we have the material that we mentioned briefly in the art library in my library. And also there's a small portrait show up in the Francis Lehman Loam Art Center on a photography landing. So you helped to curate this exhibit, so can you tell me why these things were selected from the house? And
Yes. It's actually, I must credit instead our Vice President, Millay Society Vice President Mark Oberski. He curated the exhibition with the help of a few board members, but mostly really I would say it was Mark who put the exhibition together. I certainly looked at the list and agreed with all of his choices.
The material's stunning, and it's really beautifully displayed, so he's very good at mounting an exhibition, I have to say.
He did a beautiful job in both of these sites. Yeah. And I think, as I mentioned, you know, thanks to Norma, Steepletop is a treasure trove of artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she kept everything in the house almost exactly as Millay left it.
That's so astonishing. She lived in it all those decades, and it's just as, I mean, even, you know, the hairbrushes and bottles on the dressers are just
exactly.
as Millay left them.
So, most extraordinary, she hung her own clothes on the shower rack so that she could leave in Millay's bathroom so she wouldn't disturb Millay's clothes hanging in the closet. For 36 years she lived that way, from 1950 to 86. Well, she considered the house a shrine to her sister's memory.
Really obviously an act of love.
And in a way sort of a possessiveness of what had been.
Yeah.
You know, wanted to be sure that Millay was seen
properly, remembered,
with such great respect. So, but back to the exhibition, there are really two themes. In the library, the exhibit is organized according to the four New England seasons.
Mm-hmm.
In the spring section, you can find Millay's bird-watching binoculars, garden tools. In summer, you can see barware from that outdoor bar I mentioned.
Yeah, beautiful cocktail shaker, I have to say.
Yes, just cocktail shaker.
Encapsulates the 1920s there in a nice way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A wine glass.
Mm-hmm.
And wine, actually, they made wine. They didn't grow grapes, but they did make wine.
You actually have a bottle of her wine.
Scary thought. Taste that wine. Then moving into autumn, you'll find her Wedgwood Witch China tea service.
Yeah. Very strange and beautiful that is.
Yes,
I have to
it
say.
Is. Looks like a Halloween.
Yes, it tells you something about her taste, and that it's exquisite, but it's very quirky also.
Yes, very quirky, and there is certainly that side to her.
Yeah. And a kind of child, child's sensibility.
Yes, exactly. I mean, sort of orange. It does look like a Halloween, but it's a beautiful service at the same time. And then in that same part of the exhibition, you'll see her jeweled compact, her silken rhinestone scarf.
Her lipstick. All that stuff is just so beautiful.
Norma left her lipstick in her handbags, in the drawer, her lipsticks and even Kleenex in the drawer, just as they were when Millay died.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, I think it's fun that in the winter section of the exhibition, you can see the sleigh bells from Millay's sleigh.
Yeah.
On the one hand, and on the other hand, seashells that she collected.
Yes,
she had a seashell collection, which is still on display in the dining room.
Yeah, I was fascinated by that because they're on display like fine china, but they're just ordinary seashells. They're very, very beautiful. They're things of nature, but they are things of nature, essentially.
Yes, and I think that does represent Millay's appreciation for the beauty of nature, for the things of nature.
Yeah.
I mean, the writing cabin I mentioned is a very simple wood writing cabin.
Mm-hmm.
With a wood stove and a little desk and a chair. There are no trappings of a poet who had any aspirations to look anything but. She didn't care about anything extra. She just wanted a space.
Yeah, well, obviously, Steepletop was geared to provide a kind of quiet around her so that she could work. It's a working space in a way. I mean, you get that sense, and that's very important, I suppose.
It's very important, and once again, Eugen helped make that happen.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
He answered all her mail.
Yeah.
He did her contracts
for
reading tours. I mentioned reading tours. She traveled around the country and packed houses doing reading tours and really was a kind of rock star in her day.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's something that We can't really appreciate that she
went across the country by
train.
And filled up places like the Hollywood Bowl, sometimes 2 days in a row, just reading poetry. Could any poet today do that, I wonder? You know, I don't know.
Perhaps an actual rock star. Maybe Lady Gaga could
Maybe Lady Gaga, if she was able to recite poetry,
Right. So back to the exhibition, I think, you know, there are books, there are poems, there's sheet music that she wrote. That's in the library.
Mm-hmm.
And in your art library are the larger artifacts, as we mentioned earlier, including one of the gowns that she read poetry in, her size 4.5 embroidered shoes.
Yeah, beautiful shoes, all sequins and feathers. Yeah,
tiny shoes, her traveling typewriter, the Remington, and of course, as we mentioned before, her saddle, her rifle.
Yeah.
Her snowshoes. The
snowshoes, yes. Very important to her, those snowshoes weren't that she would often mention them in correspondence, I know. And when she had her snowshoes with her, she was at a place she could think of as home, in a sense.
And they use those snowshoes, certainly Eugen, to walk down to the post office at the foot of the hill and back.
And when she describes herself in the correspondence that had to do with Renaissance, she mentions that she's able to climb fences in snowshoes. I remember that line. So it was an accomplishment.
That's great.
Yeah.
So the third exhibition is installed in the photography gallery. And those are silver prints, 3 silver prints of Millay on loan from the Society, 2 by Bernice Abbott, and the third by Herman Mishkin. There's also a photograph from Mark Oberski's private collection, mm-hmm. and a charcoal drawing, which is owned by Vassar.
And we have a small Man Ray in the art case also that came from the house,
I think. From the house.
So she was photographed by very famous photographers.
She was indeed.
And seems to have had some idea of how important it was to control her image.
Yes. And that young scholars have written about that,
about her image.
Yeah. I should say young scholars across the board have written about that, because she was extremely careful about how she was portrayed.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see her smiling and laughing and throwing her head back, except in some footage that we just recently discovered.
I use that on the Library Cafe website, actually, is still from that footage where she's laughing, throwing her head back, because it seems so unusual. I mean, you couldn't find photographs like that. It really gives you a sense of her as a person.
But, so in these photographs by Mishkin and by Bernice Abbott, mm-hmm. you'll see her looking rather, I would say, poetic, mm-hmm. sophisticated, rarely smiling, sometimes with a tie, a shirt and tie, which is this wonderful androgynous look that she favored.
Yeah, her dress, she reminds me of a portrait of Shelley that actually she has in her library. There mm-hmm. was a famous portrait, and there weren't very many of Shelley.
Right.
Same collar.
But that's her controlled image.
Yeah.
This footage that I mentioned was very generously lent to us by Michael Cook.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael Cook is the grandson of Deems Taylor,
uh-huh.
the composer,
yeah.
whom Millay worked on The King's Henchmen,
uh-huh.
on that opera I
uh-huh.
mentioned. Deems Taylor wrote the music, of course.
Yeah.
And this is footage that is just, it's marvelous.
Yeah, it's haunting.
So you see them parading around Millay and Deems' wife, parading around in terry cloth robes, it's all at Steepletop,
mm-hmm.
as they prepare to go skinny dip in the pool.
Mm-hmm.
And then in another frame, you can see Millay and her friends wearing silk dresses and furs, looking very flapper,
mm-hmm.
stylish.
Yeah.
Looking very 1920s.
Yeah.
In another frame, you can see them preparing to have a large party at
mm-hmm.
Steepletop,
yes, uh-huh.
where about 60 people attended, and you see a traveling group of players
mm-hmm.
who are setting up on the hill
mm-hmm.
to perform. They're called the Jitney Players,
uh-huh.
and they're about to perform a play for Millay and her guests.
Looks like a hot day. The men all have their shirts off.
Yes, that's right. And Eugene's walking around in his shorts. It's really quite wonderful.
Yeah,
and Millay walking with her dogs.
Yeah.
She had her lovely dogs.
Mm-hmm.
One of her dogs used to lie in her cabin and sleep while she recited poetry, her German Shepherd.
How important was Vassar in the course of her formation as a poet? Often we would hear this quote about this pink and gray world that she seemed to be happy to be out of in some ways, but Vassar was important to her. Yes, I get a sense otherwise that it was. I mean, she was glad to be at Vassar, and she certainly took part in campus life and the drama society, but also just her life in general, right?
Yes, I mean, I think Vassar was critical to her development
uh-huh.
as a person and as a poet, certainly. She loved her courses, as I mentioned before. She loved drama and she loved the classics. Professor Elizabeth Hazelson Hayes, who was a Latin teacher and became close friends with Millay later on, wrote a really wonderful article about Millay's life at Vassar in the Vassar Alumni Magazine the year after she died, 1951. But I think as a student, Millay was very prolific. She played in pageants. She wrote plays, songs, poems for college events. She wrote the baccalaureate hymn. She wrote for graduation. She wrote poems for the tree ceremonies, and I'm not sure if they still perform the tree ceremonies at Vassar, but that was a tradition.
It seems to have fallen by the wayside, unfortunately. Although we did have an odd tree ceremony with an artist that we had come from Germany, Barbara Beisinghoff, this September, but it wasn't part of our tradition. I mean, she brought that to us. So,
interesting. Remember that she was 21 when she started class.
A little older than...
A little older than the norm.
Mm-hmm.
And so this made some of the other students respectful.
Mm-hmm.
And some jealous, and it put the president, Henry Noble McCracken, in a rather interesting position, a challenging position. No matter what he did, he wasn't about to see her expelled. And he really was, I would say, her greatest ally, because she was a bit of a troublemaker.
Yeah, she did push the envelope a bit,
didn't
she?
She loved to cut classes, and if you will, I'll read you a few excerpts from an interview with McCracken that is published in one of the Vassar yearbooks in 1966. He was asked, what about her cutting classes? I mean, was this something that she did routinely? And he said, oh, yes, she cut everything. He said, I once called her and told her, I want you to know that you couldn't break any rule that would make me vote for your expulsion. I don't want to have any dead Shelleys on my doorstep, and I don't care what you do. She went to the window and looked out, and she said, well, on those terms, I think I can continue to live in this hellhole. Now, he also talks about questioning her one day mm-hmm. when she'd cut a class and he saw her outside. Mm-hmm. He says, "Oh, yes," this is from McCracken, "in those days, students could absent themselves whenever they pleased and just send in a sick excuse. I stopped her in the hall one of those times and I said, 'Vincent, you sent in a sick excuse at 9 o'clock this morning, and at 10 o'clock, I happened to look out the window of my office, and you were trying to kick out the light in the chandelier on top of the Taylor Hall arch."
It's still there, that chandelier, so yes. Uh-huh.
"Which seemed a rather lively little exercise for someone so taken with illness." "She looked very solemnly at me and said to me, 'Prexy, at the moment of your class, I was in pain with a poem.'" And then McCracken says, "What could you do with a girl like that?"
Yeah, funny.
So, yeah. Again, he was very supportive of her, yeah. but he was also aware that some of the faculty was a bit annoyed by
yes,
her
yeah.
constant mm-hmm. just disregard for the rules.
So on graduation, she had a problem with graduation, didn't she? They almost stopped her from graduating, yes, because of almost a stroke of bad luck from
yes.
something that happened to
well,
her.
Well, it was a stroke of bad luck. She had left campus, which mm-hmm. she often did,
yeah.
and she often left without permission. And she'd been grounded, and then when she was grounded, she went out again.
Uh-huh.
And when she was out, she made the grievous error of signing her name in a guest book
mm-hmm.
in a hotel
yeah.
underneath the name of a man. And they assumed that perhaps she
oh.
was there with him.
Uh-huh.
So she was grounded, and she was told that she couldn't graduate with her class. And McCracken just sort of stood by to see what would happen.
Yes, uh-huh.
And they put a petition together, which was signed by the faculty.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually she was reinstated,
yeah.
and she was able to graduate. But she did miss the singing of the baccalaureate hymn, which she had written. And so she was very sad about that.
She had tremendous support on campus there with that
yes.
petition, didn't she? Both with faculty and students.
Yes, and she did. And in the yeah. end, and for all of her troublemaking, you know, she was charming
yeah.
and certainly brilliant and talented.
Yeah.
And was making a name for herself, which was also, of course, yeah. making a name for Vassar.
Yeah, you get that sense of her from the videos. She's very charming, obviously. Very forceful person, a small redhead.
Her
fiery
size
kind of
and not really
no.
indicative of her strength.
So how well-known is Millay today, do you find? Someone who's devoted part of your life to her work and life. Is she known at all by younger audiences? And if so, can you give an example?
Well, Millay is actually very well-known. Certainly most of us who attended schools in America have read and studied at least one or two of her more popular poems,
yeah.
more anthologized poems.
Yes, and we who remember the 60s will remember her because she became very popular then
yes,
because of her.
That's right.
Know,
she was a resurgence
yeah.
of interest during feminism,
yeah.
actually in the 70s as well,
yeah,
in the
yeah.
50s and the 70s. Feminist critics started writing about Millay
yeah.
and looking more closely at her work. But most people have read or heard My Candle Burns at Both Ends,
yeah.
some of the more famous sonnets.
Yeah.
I mentioned Love Is Not All, or What Lips My Lips Have Kissed. But there's also an impressively large contingent of devoted Millay fans
mm-hmm.
who continue to read and quote her. And as literary executor, I hear from playwrights, novelists, composers
mm-hmm.
who continue to incorporate her poetry in their work or set it to
mm-hmm.
music.
Yeah.
Leonard Bernstein
uh-huh.
set What Lips My Lips Have Kissed
mm-hmm.
to music. Now, a case in point about her readership, her collected poems has never gone out of print.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, Harper Perennial published an updated edition in 2012. That's the very thick book,
yeah.
thick, thick of all of her work, most of her work. And they asked me to write an essay that would reintroduce Millay
mm-hmm.
to a modern audience. So there's a short essay in the back of the book. I also included excerpts from letters
yes.
and photos, so you can see that Millay, she is a modern figure, and that, of course, has been one of my goals,
mm-hmm.
is to reintroduce people or have people discover or rediscover
mm-hmm.
how modern her work is. Now, in terms of younger audiences, I'm happy to report that millennials
mm-hmm.
and other readers are indeed discovering her work on social media. And just last week, I was thrilled to see Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Mm-hmm.
On his Twitter feed, he tweeted this. He said, "Went down a sonnet reading wormhole this morning, and Enda St. Vincent Millay knocked me out, as she so often does." And he quoted a love sonnet.
Yeah.
Not in a silver casket,
cool
with pearls.
Uh-huh.
And that evening, same evening, after some discussion
mm-hmm.
from others about how much they loved her work, he tweeted a YouTube video of Millay
uh-huh.
reading Love Is Not All.
Oh.
And he mentioned that that was one of his favorite sonnets. So I would say that she's an iconic figure, and what happens, like with anything else, now that you've heard this
mm-hmm.
and you start looking in any of your modern literature, your daily reading, you'll see that she's quoted.
Yes, still, yeah. So she still has this popular audience, happily.
Yes.
And she always did have a popular audience. What about scholarly audiences, which are more problematic, I know? She wasn't well received by the rash of poets who followed her, people like Eliot. Well, we think it was the modern movement, was she?
Not at all.
And the academics.
Because she was considered a popular poet, mm-hmm. because she was a best-selling poet,
yes.
because she was read by the masses.
Yeah, Kiss of Death. I remember this same conversation we had about Saul Steinberg and his work as an artist, that he just couldn't be taken seriously. Of course, you know, the joke there is that the problem with comedy is that nobody takes it seriously, but in her case, because she was reaching a mass audience, it's hard to get a serious academic attention.
That's correct, and I think really it's about timing, because she was right in the crux of modernism.
Uh-huh.
So once Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot, once their voices were heard, you know, they were talking about the fragmentation of society and how it can be expressed in poetry and the use of not just imagery but symbolism and illusion, that the more obscure the better.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Millay really was, we're talking about a person who believed in Wordsworth, spontaneous overflow of feeling.
Yes, uh-huh.
And so this was just in direct opposition to what was happening in modernism. However, that said, she continued to have an audience.
Yes, uh-huh.
And there's some marvelous essays written by Sandra Gilbert, Susan Gubar, about how one of Millay's challenges is that she was a successful poet.
Yes.
And especially the male critics didn't like that.
Yes.
You know, she was making a very good living as a poet, in fact, getting rich as a poet.
Yeah. And we were all reading her even as children, you know. So,
Sandberg and. Millay and Robert Frost were best selling poets in America for decades.
Yes, yeah.
And I think that's important to note. And once again, there's so many theories about why her work was not accepted by the. But modernism was different. You know, Marianne Moore.
Yeah.
And others that came in.
Elizabeth Bishop.
And Elizabeth Bishop and Louise Bogan. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are people who actually, certainly Louise Bogan, who wrote for The New Yorker, she wrote about Millay, and she was very fair about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she talked about her sort of level of emotion and the pitch of her emotion, but the importance of her work as well.
Yeah, yeah. Which is a very honest poet. It's modern in that, so. Can you talk about the revolutionary aspects of her poetry then? I mean, her poetry is edgy in a sense, isn't it, as far as what was happening in poetry goes, sort of general?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
No question. I mean, I think we talked about My Candle Burns of Old Ends,
mm-hmm.
but I think what's interesting to note is that, and her, just to her audience for a moment, it wasn't just female, even
mm-hmm.
though we've mentioned female,
it was a
female audience. She gave women a voice in poetry that they hadn't had before. And I think what's edgy about her poetry is that she adopted female sexuality as one of her
mm-hmm.
themes. She emboldened women by allowing them to become the subject rather than the object mm-hmm. in her poems. Her sonnets, for example, "I too, being born a woman and distressed by all the needs and notions of my kind," or "I too, beneath your moon, almighty sex, go forth at nightfall crying like a cat." And so she was very open about women's sexuality, women's needs,
mm-hmm.
which were not the subject of poetry before.
No.
So, you know, she rejected the traditional role of the woman in love poems, for example.
Yeah.
You know, she would say, "Oh, think not I am faithful to a vow," or "Whether or not we find what we are seeking is idle, biologically speaking." So the male lover in traditional male love poetry, certainly the male lover plays a primary role. The male is the suitor, and he longs for this beautiful, unattainable.
Yeah. So the male's the subject and the woman is the object.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But as the object, the woman doesn't get the attention.
No.
I mean, what really happens is Millay rejects this dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
She reverses the gender roles. She gives the starring role to the female lover.
Mm-hmm.
Who consequently then assumes the authority in the relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that was revolutionary.
Yeah.
And you see it in so many of Millay's sonnets. It's she who suffers. And at the same time, because she has a voice, she's the one who dares to reject her suitor.
Yeah, she's in control, essentially.
Yes.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And she can even insult or taunt her suitor for underestimating her.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of my favorite sonnets is, in Tanay's vernacular, we would say that she's talking to a man who has a sexist attitude.
Mm-hmm.
But she says, oh, you will be sorry for that word. Give me back my book and take my kiss instead. Was it my enemy or my friend I heard? What a big book for such a little head. But she's brilliant. She's a brilliant verbal strategist.
Yeah.
She did indeed. That's the revolutionary aspect, I think, that now appeals to a younger audience and certainly a contemporary audience. Her woman in love,
mm-hmm.
this composite portrait, is vulnerable emotionally, but she's not afraid to admit that she's motivated not just by wanting a relationship, but by sexuality, female sexuality.
And she's very thoughtful about it all. You always get a sense that she's looking at herself from a distance almost in these relationships and not sure whether it's worth the energy, actually, the love relationship.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Yeah. In fact, she's motivated by this tension between living for love, you know, the romantic love, or living as an artist, which is guided by her creative mind. And we see that in much of her work, and I think there's, another favorite sonnet, which she shows the theme that recurs throughout not only the poetry, but certainly in her satirical sketches, in her prose, is this mind-body tension. Pity me not, because the heart is slow to learn what the quick mind holds at every turn.
Yes, yeah, beautiful line that is.
Yes.
So how did you become interested in Millay? I mean, you seem to have a special affinity for her.
Well, you know, my own mother read poetry to me when I was a child, and with many other poets that have now gone out of favor, like Edgar Guest, for example.
I went to Edgar Guest Junior High School, actually. In fact, he may have come around to speak at one time when I was a child.
Really?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I remember memorizing his poetry as a child, which was it was what it was, actually, in rhyming, very traditional. Yeah. I'd say my childhood favorite was probably Robert Frost.
Oh, okay.
And I'd always read lots of poetry, though, frankly, she was not among one of my favorites. As I was growing up, I was reading Adrienne Rich, Anne Sexton, Audre Lorde, you know, Montale, Borges, Neruda, Yeats, very different kinds of poets. And my all-time favorite was Rainer Maria Rilke. But I didn't really discover Millay until rediscover her until the early 1980s, when I wanted to write about Rilke. But obviously, looking for a degree in English literature, he didn't write in English. So I ended up thinking, well, I'll just go back to a poet that I loved, Millay. And to my delight, I found that her sister Norma was still alive, living in the house, up at Steepletop. And I went up to see if I could do any research on her, if she could help me. And Norma was quite a character. She was very selective about her visitors.
Yeah, by all accounts.
And she was 89 when I met her. But she really put me through. She really put me through a drill in order to get in to meet her. When I called there, first she said, "What makes you think you're worthy of writing about my sister?" And then she said, "I'm going to recite a poem. If you like it, you may come and visit me." And the poem was like this: "Out of the universities hop the parasitic fleas, the newly appointed PhDs, doctors and critics overnight. All they do is write and write and write and write. Do you want to visit me?" She said.
That's so funny. She was quite a poet herself, I suppose.
Yes, she was quite a character.
Yeah.
So I did. I drove up on the hill. I got to know her, and I had a most marvelous and unique experience living with her there, off and on, for the few years before she died, because she wanted a keeper of the flame. Now, the literary executor at the time was a marvelous friend of mine and obviously close friend to Norma, named Elizabeth Barnett. And through Elizabeth, I learned all about Norma and understood how this really was. Norma's entire life goal was to preserve Millay's memory. And so I appealed to her because I was about to do that. I wanted to write about her. Norma didn't like academics, but she liked the fact that I was going to, in some way, help her promote Millay's poetry. So I stayed there for the next couple of years, as I said, and one of my experiences there, which is most memorable to me, was one night when she asked me to try on the gowns, Millay's gowns, that were hanging in the closet.
How strange.
Yes, well, her reasoning was, I want to see if there are any holes in them, I want to see what shape they're in. But I think for Norma, it was also kind of a dress-up, almost like a throwback to her childhood, in which, you know, she would have someone dress up. And then, thankfully, she had an old Polaroid camera, and she took some Polaroids.
Oh, wow.
So I have shots of me and the guy with exactly Millay's size. And so I tried on probably 6 or 7 of the gowns. Yeah. I tried on many of her other clothes. It was really quite an intimate experience to feel that close to the poet.
I imagine. So your scholar coming in trying to understand Millay and get a feel for her, and there you are trying on her clothes.
Yes, it really.
Talk about embodied, embodied scholarship.
I think I've never heard that, but I think that from now on it was definitely embodied scholarship. But it gave me also a feeling for this public and private Millay we mentioned earlier, and that is that this is the same woman who wore these flowing gowns, who had donned this black and red checked hunting jacket and taken a 22 and walking into the forest.
Yes,
so I think that was a marvelous experience. But it was also very helpful to me as a scholar because Norma asked me to memorize.
Yes, I was going to say, same sort of thing in that, you know, sort of clothing yourself in a way by memorizing her poetry.
Anything I wanted to talk about, any poem I wanted to talk about, Norma insisted that I memorize.
That's wonderful.
And present to her. And she also, remember, she'd been an actress, and she fancied herself as an acting coach. And so it was, we took, they were hours and hours, and I do have some tapes of these also, of her telling me exactly. So he came back into her house again and coaching me on how to memorize it.
So when you're reading here, you're not reading in the same style, quite expounding.
I know many things by heart. But I also, I do think that knowing by heart, which is an old art form that has somewhat gone out of style, is a very helpful way of understanding the poem from the inside out.
Yes, I agree entirely. I have a somewhat strange memory for lyric, so I got volumes.
So that's really how I got interested. Once I met Norma, I knew that this was something, really a subject I wanted to pursue. The fascination of, and I mentioned biographical criticism, you know, that interests me greatly, and I did have to temper that interest because I found that it didn't always work with Millay necessarily, that there was so much of the posing in her work.
So you could sort of deconstruct it, I suppose, or
at least get and also it. I had to distance myself from Norma's own opinions because Norma was certainly always on Millay's side, and she had her own interpretations of the work, which then sometimes I would dispute.
She published a book of Millay's posthumous poetry.
Yes, she published Mine the Harvest. And after Millay died, she published, and it's really a wonderful collection. She went into the cabin and up into Millay's study, and she found fragments of poetry. And also went through her journals, and she published much of that.
There's a book out, just out, actually, as it happens, by Yale University Press, Selected Poetry of Edna St. Vincent Millay. And you did the introduction for that book, and you are also the literary executor. So on that book, did you have a hand in selecting the material for it?
Well, I worked closely with Tim Jackson.
Yes,
Tim Jackson is the
editor of, the,
of
volume,
that
yes,
book, and I'd actually worked with Tim for 10 years before that. He'd written his dissertation about Millay. And he really made the choices. He made the initial selections. I made suggestions along the way. He's a very good scholar. And I enjoyed working with him on the book. And I will say that he was very careful in choosing poems and essays, actually her essay on faith and translations. It's a unique choice of her work. We've never seen a selection like that before. He really pulls from all the various genres, and he did a beautiful job. I wrote the introduction. The idea was to create a comprehensive introduction to introduce readers to Millay. And just a note on this book, Yale University Press, it came out in April. We're very pleased that this is an academic edition.
Very much.
And you mentioned earlier that she was a popular poet and often not read by academics. It's not that she wasn't read so much, but at this point, her work again is...
She wasn't treated critically.
She wasn't really considered a member of the canon.
No, yes.
And I think this Yale book is moving in the right direction.
Great. So as a literary executor, can you talk about your duties? I mean, what's it like to be an executor for an author like Millay? I mean, is there material yet to be published that you have to think about, say, letters lying around the house, that kind of thing? which would be a surprise, I suppose, at this point.
I don't think they're lying around the house, but there are definitely materials yet to be published. The letters, certainly, and also Millay's diaries, and there's several scholars now interested in pursuing these both these projects. They're both large projects. Tim Jackson, I mentioned, the editor of the Yale collection, has expressed some interest in publishing another letters collection. But essentially my role is really to represent the Millay Society and screen the various requests that come in to include Millay's work in anthologies, in plays, novels, film scripts, and the like. And I will say, as an executor, I'm quite lenient, meaning that I grant permission gladly. I'm very happy to have her work out there. Unless, you know, a poem is misquoted or included out of order or rewritten in some way, which is very rare. But I will say it's an exciting time for Millay because over the past several years, translations have appeared. Books of translations in Italian, Spanish, Greek, German.
Have you thought about translating her yourself? Because you spent time in Rome, teaching.
Yes, I did. I'm not translated.
No,
I mostly translate the other way.
Okay.
The language into English.
Oh, I see. Okay. So do you have a long-term vision for Steepletop? I mean, this is a kind of endeavor that necessarily seems, as it was for Vincent's sister, a real labor of love for everybody involved. And so is there a motivating force here that keeps this all together? You know, this notion of a house museum devoted to a poet who's passed away, you know, maybe the spirit of Vincent, or whatever is owed to Vincent's admirers yet. What motivates you all to engage in all this labor keeping this house up and transforming it into a museum?
Well, I think I'll answer the first question first, and that is our long-term vision for Steepletop is to continue as a house museum that offers tours of the house and gardens, access to the poetry trail. But in the future, we'd like to increase the number of educational events that we hold on site, featuring writers and scholars. We hope to expand our offerings by partnering with academic institutions that might use the site for academic events, literary conferences, alumni gatherings. And as is the case with all literary estates, I think, working for the cause is definitely a labor of love for all of us on the Millay board and for all our friends, for all our volunteers. I should mention the president of the board, Vincent Barnett, is the daughter of the former literary executor I mentioned and is named after Edna St. Vincent Millay. She is. Now, also the motivating force. What's the motivating force? I think for all of us involved in the Millay Estate, it's a shared belief that culture is among the basic tenets of a civilized society, that the sharing of experience, whether it's through life stories, poetry, drama, music, painting, dance, whatever art form, not only brings us together, but it deepens our understanding of the human condition, you know, the human predicament. I mean, it's a broad answer, I'd say, but I think that's basically what is really motivating all of us.
Especially in these times, we need as much culture as possible.
I would tend to agree with that. We do.
Yes. For me, you know, as a librarian, my experience of the house was very much, it's a very poetic experience in a sense. It's like reading the poetry. And the house has the flavor for me of a library in a sense, and that both kinds of institutions are about recovering the past in a way and translating the past into the present and into people's actual experience. And it's also a very peaceful, you know, tranquil place, like a library, you know, that induces reflection for one, you know. So
yes, I would tend to agree with that. I think Millay probably would love that concept because she considered Steepletop her haven, her sanctuary where she could write.
Great. So
I want to be sure to mention that there's an exciting project that will debut at Vassar on February 18th, the same day as the opening of the exhibition, which will commemorate, of course, the poet's 125th birthday and the 100th anniversary of her graduation. And that is a project which was created and will be directed by Chris Grabowski, professor of drama and director of the Experimental Theater of Vassar College. And that is called the Vassar College's Millay Project. And this is a dramatic presentation. It will include Millay's poetry, musical settings of her work, excerpts from letters to and from the poet, and it promises to be an inspiring production. I'm very excited about it.
Yeah, we all are. I am think, very much. Yeah.
Yes, and that again, that will debut on February 18th. Yeah.
And are you going to be part of the presentation?
I will actually talk about Millay before the presentation, and I will introduce it.
Wonderful.
I'll be part of the program. But this dramatic presentation, I expect to be.
And there are other activities too. With the Steepletop exhibit itself, there are events planned for the spring, so those will all be posted.
They will be posted. This presentation, the Millay Project, the Vassar College's Millay Project, will also be presented in New York. Yeah. And in Boston, and then at Steepletop in the spring.
So I encourage everyone, I certainly encourage people to visit Steepletop, especially after May when we have our Vassar materials there, and so generally speaking, but also encourage people to visit the Art Library and the Main Library and the Francis Lehman Mobile Art Center here at Vassar now until June 11th to see the exhibit. And we have a free catalog of the exhibit that we'll be publishing also. I think there's a catalog of the exhibit at Steepletop that's planned also. Colton Johnson has written a nice nice essay about Vincent's time at Vassar. So I'd like to thank you, Holly, for visiting with us today in the Library Cafe to talk about Edna St. Vincent Millay, the Millay Society, and the exhibition Edna St. Vincent Millay Treasures at Steepletop up at Vassar until June 11th.
Yes, and thank you for having me. I'm once again, the Millay Society is very happy to be working with Vassar, and we welcome you all to visit Steepletop, millay.org. You can find out all about it. and also, of course, to visit the exhibition.
Yeah, it's wonderful. So thank you again.